chapter 27, aren't
oh,
we?
Oh, yeah. Happy verse. Lamentations of Tyre. Tyre. Is it Tyre or Tyre?
Tyre is how it's often pronounced. You know, it's like...
This type of title for it is the sinking of Tyre.
Yeah. Yeah, Tyre is down in Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
Tyre. Tyre and grit. Mary knows. So last time in chapter 26, we saw these two chapters are tied together. So chapter 26, we saw the prediction of the overthrow of Tyre by a series of nations, like, and it made the analogy of waves hitting a shore, and we saw how Nebuchadnezzar came and took the land part of Tyre, and then later on Alexander the Great came and took the built a causeway out to the island part of Tyre, and then that was rebuilt after that, and then eventually during the time of the Crusades, the Crusaders had that area, and then the Muslims came in the 13th century and wiped it out by attacking the Crusaders, and that's pretty much the end of it as far as it being a power of any sort. So we looked at that last time. And so this is going on now, talking more about, in this chapter, the commercial aspect of Tyre. And so one of the things, and we've talked about this before too, is as you read through the Old Testament, one of the themes that pops up a lot is the idea of the pride of man. And the pride of man, not just individual men, but mankind in general. Obviously the Tower of Babel would be an example of that.
Disneyland, maybe?
Disneyland, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Saw that everywhere.
Yeah.
Tower of Disneyland.
And part of it is, the part you kind of have to separate as you go along is, you can misread some of these passages as if God's just a giant killjoy and he doesn't like anything. But that's not really what he's saying. What he's saying is he doesn't like to see man's creativity and abilities used in a way that's disconnected from him. Because, you know, essentially, when we've talked about this too, when you really boil down what sin is independence.
Mm-hmm.
It's an independence from God. It's an imagination that you're doing these things because of your own capabilities or the innate capability of man has it. Like today in our secular culture, of course, that rejects the whole idea of God in the Bible. There's this idea that man is going to evolve himself to some level. I mean, there's even a group of people, you know, that believe that mankind is going to be transformed into something else by their own intelligence. Humanism, this whole idea of overcoming immortality, mm-hmm. overcoming mortality through biotechnology and so forth. So there's a thrust of creativity that we have, which is God-given, and God wants us to use it to glorify him. But when we use it in ways that damage and don't glorify him, then that's where the pride of man takes off kind of on its own. And so some of the areas where you see that focus come about is in this area of influence and trade. And that's why, you know, in the book of Revelation, when it focuses on Babylon in chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation, you see a heavy emphasis on the influence and the trade and the economic power of Babylon. And it's not like God isn't against the economy, and he's not against people wisely using resources. I mean, you look in the scripture, you've got people like Solomon, right, and David, pretty powerful and wealthy at times. Abraham was a wealthy man. But it's the problem that comes along where it's disconnected. So having kind of prophesied the destruction of the city in chapter 26, it's going to go now into this area where it's giving more of a feel for the economic powerhouse that Tyre was at the time. So having said that, is there anyone that wants to like jump in and go like 25 verses. There's quite a few weird cities and people.
Yeah, man. No,
go
thanks.
For it.
Probably get screwed up. But the word of the Lord came again to me, saying, "Now, son of man, take up a lamentation for Tyre, and say to Tyre, you who are situated at the entrance of the sea, merchant of the peoples on many coastlands, thus says the Lord God, O Tyre, you have said, I am perfect in beauty. Your borders are in the midst of the seas. Your builders have perfected your beauty. They made all your planks of fir trees from cedar. They take a cedar from Lebanon to make you a mat. Of oaks from Bashan, they make your oars. The company of Asherites have inlaid your planks with ivory from the coast of Cyprus. Fine embroidered linen from Egypt was what you spread for your sail. Blue and purple from the coast of Elisha was what covered you. Inhabitants of Sidon and Arvad were your oarsmen. Your wise men, O Tyre, were in you. They became your pilots. Elders of Gebal and its wise men were in you to caulk your seams. All the ships of the sea and your oarsmen were in you to market your merchandise. Those from Persia, Lydia, and Libya were in your army as men of war. They hung shield and helmet in you. They gave splendor to you. Men of Arvad with your army were on your walls all around, and men of Hamad were in your towers. They hung their shields on your walls all around and made you your beauty perfect. Tarshish was your merchant because of your many luxury goods. They gave you silver, iron, tin, and lead for your goods. Javan, Tubal, and Meshach were your traders. They bartered human lives and vessels of bronze for your merchandise. Those from the house of Togarma traded for your wares with horses, steeds, and mules. The men of Dedan were your traders. Many isles were the market of your hand. They brought you ivory, tusks, and ebony as payment. Syria was your merchant because of the abundance of goods you made. They gave you for all your wares purple, embroidery, fine linen, corals, and rubies. Judah and the land of Israel were your traders. They traded for your merchandise wheat, millet, honey, oil, and balm. Damascus was your merchant because of the abundance of goods you made, because of your many luxury items, with the wine of Helbon and with white wool. Dan and Javan paid for your wares, traversing back and forth, brought iron, cassia, and cane were among your merchandise. Dedan was your merchant in saddle cloths for riding. Arabia and all the princes of Kedar were your regular merchants. They traded with you in lambs, rams, and goats. The merchants of Sheba and Arama were your merchants. They traded for your wares the choicest spices of all kinds of precious stones and gold. Haran, Canaan, Eden, the merchants of Sheba, Assyria, Chilmad were your merchants. These were your merchants in choice items, in purple clothes, in embroidered garments. chest, the multicolored apparel, and sturdy woven cords, which were in your marketplace.
Yeah.
One more verse, anyway.
The ships of Tarshish were carriers of your merchandise. You were pot filled and very glorious in the midst of the sea.
Thanks, Jerry. You can take the week off now.
Yeah.
That's the most we've had done.
That's great.
Either way.
Pretty amazing, isn't it? When you listen to somebody read through it, it's just you get some feel for the kind of connections that this place has.
Yeah, and
you know, a lot of these names come from the names of people who, you know, from Genesis 10 and elsewhere, where they went out and settled different parts of the area. And I have a little chart here. This is like a map. You can't see it real well, but it shows the Mediterranean area, and you can, if I can zoom right, you know, there's all these different names from different people in different places, and most of these plus further ones are listed in this trade. So you had this place which is right on the coast over here, right? We're looking at Tyre just off the coast on this side, and it's trading, depending on where you take Tarshish to be. A lot of people think it's southern Spain, which is out here, but you know, if you look at Ebony and some of the other things they're getting stuff from Africa, and they're getting stuff all the way up through this area of Turkey and Greece and so forth. So they're basically trading with the whole Mediterranean area and even down into the Arabian Peninsula. And some people feel too that they think there's evidence they were trading as far as Great Britain. And so, you know, it was a maritime powerhouse back then, and had access to more of a variety of goods than most places, right? Mm-hmm. And so that you can kind of see that when you read this thing, because there's all these strange names of places, you know, and it mentions a lot of it has to do with shipping, you know. And as it said in the last chapter, when Nebuchadnezzar overthrew Jerusalem, that went to the advantage, or at least Tyre thought it would go to their advantage, because Jerusalem was situated in a place where a lot of the trade, overland trade, would go through Jerusalem. And then when Jerusalem was sacked, they didn't have the city there anymore, and so a lot of that trade ended up, they thought it would divert through Tyre. But you can see that Tyre was, it'd be like a, you know, it would be like back in the, trying to think of a good analogy, but you know, today, of course, any of the big major shipping ports on the ocean, or back in the time, you know, when Great Britain, you know, had an empire all the way around, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire. Places like Liverpool would have been like this.
Where they were at, like the port, when we're down at the port of Tacoma. It's just massive.
Yeah.
Your perspective gets really messed up.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the container ships and stuff nowadays, they're just huge. So this whole business of trade is, it's not like God's against trade. It's just that almost always with this trade comes in black market stuff or slavery or other aspects. And you can see hints of it in here where it's talking about, as we've seen the part where it talks about the human lives, bartered human lives, verse 13. so, and this part we're reading is just really similar to Revelation 18, where it talks about the sea captains and the merchants associated with Babylon. So if you go through these names, you know, you basically have to have a Bible atlas or a Bible dictionary to kind of make your way through this. But in general, the names are often associated with genealogy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you go back to the Table of Nations in Genesis 10 or whatever, that came out from the sons of Noah, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Ham, Japheth, and who's the other one? Shem. Mm-hmm. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So these would be sons of those lines that settled in different areas, and then the areas became known by the names. And this also becomes kind of a sticking point sometimes when you're talking to people about prophetic passages, because there's some people who say, look, you know, because certain passages use the names of these ancient peoples, you can't think that they're going to be fulfilled future in our own time, parts of them. And of course the answer to that is, well, you know, at the time that the prophecies are given, they're given to a particular prophet or whatever, and it's related to the peoples at that time that live in those areas, right? And there's really not any other practical way to talk about it, you know. I mean, God doesn't have in here, you know, he wouldn't be talking about Americans or Jamaicans or, you know, just because at the time, what was a Jamaican or an American, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get used to this idea, and especially when we get a little bit further, we get into Ezekiel 30, 38-39, we'll see a lot of these same names used that were on that same chart I had there to describe an events and situations that nobody can find a historical fulfillment from. So the implication is that it's talking about peoples from those regions, but at a different time in history. So any thoughts about this?
Well, unless I missed something, so far in the chapter, they haven't really got to the lamentation part. We're just kind of listing. Right, it's just a big giant list.
Yeah, I stopped Jerry right on the precipice. Verse 26.
Yeah.
But an east wind.
Yeah.
Right. So what we're going to see is when we read a little bit further is, you know, God's going to bring judgment, and you can see hints that He's heading that way, because, well, not only the previous chapter, but in verse 3. O Tyre, you have said, I am perfect in beauty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when God makes the comment to a prophet that you said you're something, time to duck.
Yeah.
Right. and then in the next chapter, Ezekiel 28, which we haven't got to, but that's one of the more well-known chapters in the Old Testament, because Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 both talk about different rulers of powerful cities, and then but go beyond those rulers to the demonic power behind them, and we'll see that when we get there. So it's kind of building to a crescendo, talking about the overflow of the city and or the overthrow of the city, and then eventually it'll bring in dimensions that go beyond just the immediate city. But a lot of this gets at this idea too, that often when we experience great material blessing, that's when we forget God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the pattern is over and over in the scriptures where, you know, basically you could look at history like a rotating wheel, you know, and it's like people turn to God and they know God, He blesses them.
They ask, you ask God to help you.
Yeah, they turn to God because in their need,
mm-hmm.
and then He blesses them, and as they get blessed and become more prosperous, they become less needy, and
Think
you're self-sufficient and turn away from God, especially over a generation or two, people forget. Well, just like in our country, I mean, we're in the situation where economically we're still pretty good shape. If you don't look at the balance sheet, if you just look at the surface, it looks really good. But the fact that the balance sheet is horrible is an indicator that we're already kind of lost sight of what God is here, and we're now kind of out on a limb already.
I'm sawing it off behind us.
Yeah, and so what happens, and we're sawing it off behind us, right? And so as this wheel goes around, you have the problem where there's two things. God just doesn't, he doesn't allow people to continue being blessed and be independent of him. He's not going to bless that. And number two, he wants to get their attention and bring them around again to pay attention to what is important. And so in order to do that, he has to take things away. He has to take away the things that they're depending on or the things that they are worshiping, you know, whether it's materialism or whatever it might be. And so, you know, the fact that there's all this stuff going on is kind of, again, if you're sensitive to the biblical direction, you know that, this is not going in the right direction. But it is an amazing list here of things. You know, it talks about wool, it talks about ivory, it talks about slaves, horses, mules, honey, oil, balm, gold, and jewels, and lambs, and rams, and goats, and, you know, it's just a really a diverse list.
Spices, clothes.
Yeah, it's almost everything that they use to measure wealth. You know, you think how they did well when Abraham, he said, well, he had 10,000, I'm just not going to, 10,000 camels, 8,000, you know, females, and keep going on, and then that's how they measured wealth.
Yeah.
And so you can take that and start stripping it away.
Yeah. So you notice the mention there of the ships of Tarshish, right? And, so there's different ideas about the location of Tarshish and the use of the phrase ships of Tarshish. It's definitely obviously a geographical location because that's where Jonah flees to, Tarshish, and it's used as a specific spot, a geographical location in a lot of passages. But it also kind of takes on this idea of powerful, capable ships. And you know, there's a passage in Isaiah where it talks about God's going to take down the pride of man on all the sloops of Tarshish, and it's this idea that that passage appears to be associated with the ultimate day of the Lord, which, you know, doesn't look like it's happened yet, and yet it's using this idea, the sloops of Tarshish, this whole idea of, you know, maybe at that time there'd be big cargo container ships, or, you know, but this whole idea of powerful shipping. So the three spots that you'll see people mention the most for Tarshish, one is on the east coast of Africa, the other's in southern Spain, like the map I showed you had it down there, and another one that comes up is southwest England. And Tarshish itself means smelting. It's a smelting site. And so you saw there, talked about tin, talked about minerals, right? Mm-hmm. Where was it? Where it connected that were.
Silver, iron, tin, and lead.
Yeah, right. Silver, iron, tin, and lead in verse 12. So it's this idea. Tarshish is associated with mining, essentially, and smelting of metal.
Jasper?
Yeah. So they... the reason this Tarshish thing comes up and people pay a lot of attention to it somewhat more than you would think is because there's a we're going to see a phrase when we get to Ezekiel 38 and 39 where it talks about the young lions of Tarshish. And so that's maybe the only place I'm aware of in Scripture that people can maybe make a case that the U.S. or the Western Hemisphere is mentioned in some of these prophetic passages. Because some people think that Tarshish is England.
Because of their lion.
Yeah, possibly the lion, but also more because Southwest England was tin mining. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence of trade with that area in England before Roman times, right? Mm. Going back. So there's some people who think the ships of Tarshish went as far as to go out to England, and that reference to the young lions of Tarshish is possibly talking about Western nations that came out of Great Britain. You can't say that it's definitely not right, but it's a little bit of a stretch. You know, it's fairly tentative.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just caution if anyone's making a really big prophetic interpretation, putting a lot of weight on that, that it's kind of a it's pretty questionable whether that's really referring to
guess.
I don't really think so because usually when it seems like when God's talking about like when He mentions Jacob. He's not talking about a place. It usually has to do more with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And usually all of those are, it's more about the people than it is the land.
Mm-hmm.
And the lines of the people. And, you know, usually like Asher, that's a specific person in Scripture. Mm-hmm. And maybe he also, you know, settled the land. But it's not talking about the land, it's talking about the people.
Yeah.
Because he's the guy who plundered Jericho after, that's not that it has anything to do with that, but there's a person involved there, I think.
Yeah, but I guess you still do see passages where the names are, really talking about regions.
These are talking about cities.
Some areas had many, many names,
mm-hmm.
and so he's referring to them but the name by the name of the person
that settled there and that it was associated with.
Babel was dispersed, that's where all these
different people went, and
I would think that would be the reason.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a fine line. The names are associated with people groups for sure, the descendants of the person.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when like Dan, it talks about 19, which says Dan and Javan.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking about the tribe of Dan,
mm-hmm.
but primarily the region in that case where Dan was given the land, northern Israel, right? And so even though there's other people besides Danites living there, that region would be called Dan. Just like Judea was mostly where Judah was,
mm-hmm.
right? Judea and Samaria.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at these things, there's always a connection with the originating people group. That's how the name, 90% of the time, the name is coming from that. Even when we say like anti-Semitism, right, is based on the name Shem.
Yeah.
Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
And Tarshish comes from Japheth.
So there's this whole area of, and the terms aren't used, this is a kind of a rabbit too, but the terms aren't used as surgical precision, right? Because anti-Semitism would mean against Arabs too. A lot of them are from Shem too, right?
Yeah, basically it'd be the whole Middle East.
Yeah.
Just
so
not completely.
It's just like when people say Jew, right? I mean, I've had discussions with people on internet email about this. It's like people get weird about language, right? They it's like we go from extremes to like ignoring details to like overdoing details, right? And so like people, there's some people who think, well, the term Jew is only the Judah, line of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
None of the other 11 brothers, because Jew comes from Judah. And, you know.
Huh?
Well, that's, you know, that I'm just saying, there's all kinds of weird people, there's a lot of weird things that people get hung up on. And so this is the kind of thing where you just see weird things where people, well, okay, that's true. That's true. That's how the term came from. And if you look at Hitler's use of a Judane or whatever, mm-hmm. he's referring to a Jew, but he's not referring to the tribe of Judah, right? Mm-hmm. And so the same is true with anti-Semitism. You know, yeah, the Shemites are a lot broader than just the Jews, but the meaning of it in today's usage.
I always thought of it as a religion, and then Hebrew would be the people.
Yeah, but I think, you know, as far as anti-Semitism, you mean?
Well, yeah, people say Jews, and that covers a religion that a lot of different families believe in. They were Hebrew.
Yeah.
And so that'd be the race of what we're talking about, in a sense.
Mm-hmm, the race of Hebrews, yeah. But I mean, and it gets tricky too, because there's secular Jews,
mm-hmm.
you know, who don't follow a religion, but they would still be persecuted by Hitler, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So all I'm trying to say is, even though these terms have their origin in a particular person living in a certain region, human language is not surgical in its precision, and terms change over time.
Isn't Jewish, I don't know, but doesn't that mean, though, really, that they have to trace their bloodline back to Jacob?
Well, yeah.
So that's,
I mean,
really,
that's how
it
we
is
take
a bloodline.
It. Yeah. So when we look at these things, especially when they're controversial, or, well, they shouldn't be controversial, but when they attract a lot of weird ideas, we go to the Bible to say, okay, what is the Bible?
Yeah.
How's the Bible define that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we don't have any evidence. And when we go to the Bible, we can see pretty clearly that a Jew is defined as somebody who's in the line from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob,
mm-hmm.
all three, coming from Jacob, from one of the 12 tribes. So, you know, and again, that definition will differ quite a bit from definitions that are floated around today about whether it's the mother or the father or how that works. You know, in the Bible, it's talking about the father primarily. And now there's all these situations where people have, well, there's practical problems because there's rape and we don't know who the father is, but we know the mother is. There's all these situations that people get into, and so the actual way it's determined today might vary from the way the Bible talks about it. But me, I go back to the Bible. And I guess I mentioned before at one time, you know, the bagel diagram there.
Mm-hmm.
I was answering a question from somebody about how's the term Jew used, or Israel used, in the New Testament. What does it mean? Are there Gentiles that are ever, you know, Jews? Yeah, there's the right there, the little bullseye thing. You know, and that answer there that I answered, just on our own little website, it got posted in some Jewish forum by somebody, and oh, there was a big uproar about it.
Tony Garland, Tomato Island.
Who's this guy think he is?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Who's this guy think he is?
Oh,
defining
no.
who a Jew is.
Well, you should have changed your name to Garlandstein or something.
Yeah.
just for the article.
And I'm like, I'm not trying to define what a Jew is. I'm just trying to answer a biblical question about what does the Bible say about, how does it use the term, you know, in the New Testament. You guys can argue all you want about what you think a Jew is, but I'm not getting into that. But just to say there's certain tripwires, you know, and the Jewish stuff tends to be a tripwire.
So they're watching your website, are they?
Well, I don't know.
They're under watch.
So I came across your website the other day completely by accident.
No.
I was looking up something and, oh, yeah, look who it is answering the question.
Looking up.
Tommy.
I did a rod or something.
No.
I did a rod. Anyway, the thing about it is, you just want to kind of look, go back and look at what the how the Bible's saying these things, and you know, I think it's kind of like, you know, if you go outside in the dark and you turn on a light bulb, you wait like half an hour, and what do you got? You got like 50 moths.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the Bible, topics that the Bible touches on,
yeah,
and are of significance to God are like that light bulb,
mm-hmm,
right? As long as it stays dark, nobody pays any attention.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as that light bulb comes on, man, all the moths come flying.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you just can't believe.
Ping, 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 ping.
All these moths.
Yeah.
You know. And you get the, people will say the goofiest thing. They'll say like, well, a Jew is only someone in the line of Judah. Or they'll say, you know, like I've mentioned before, a guy who was here who came after the sermon and sat me down and tried to tell me there are no Jews anymore anywhere in the world, you know. And there's this...
Well, that's your National Geographic.
Well, they all turned into Christians.
Yeah. But it's just a weird thing, so... But anyway, the people groups and stuff, the names are kind of unusual, and some of them you have to kind of really hang onto your seat, like when you're reading a real serious section and
yeah,
it goes, talks about Dodo.
Yeah.
You know, they sound kind of funny.
I think the key is it's just all over. It's every place. It
yeah,
looks like they were quite...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, because of that, this ends up forming kind of a type of the culture at the end of man,
mm-hmm,
which is global. A global culture, nobody can buy or sell unless they
mm-hmm
have, and so there's this control of trade, and tied with worship, and so.
So this could almost be like the Book of Revelation talking about Babylon.
Yeah, if you take this chapter and you lay it next to Revelation 18,
yeah,
it's uncanny.
Yeah.
It's almost like the same person wrote those. Right.
So it's the shadow or type of...
Yeah. So this judgment of Tyre, and especially when we get to the next chapter and we find out that Satan is empowering this leader of Tyre. Well, what do we see? Who's empowering the final leader of Babylon?
Yeah.
Right?
Nothing new under the sun.
And so, for sure, it's like there's these situations where God is highlighting things in history, like whether it's the Tower of Babel or this situation here. He's like giving us multiple chances to get it, right? He's saying, you know, see these situations. This isn't the same, but look at how similar it is,
mm-hmm,
right? And so, part of it is we're supposed to be able to see these principles, because he brings them up several times, mostly because, you know, we're slow to learn. I mean, how many times have you read through the same thing and not seen something, and then
yeah,
boom, the light goes on, you go, how come I've never seen that?
Yeah.
How many times have I read through that and I've never seen that? And it's just sitting there on the page, right? That happens all the time. So anyway, so there's this whole thing he's leading up to, and I guess unless anyone has anything further, we can go to the next section. And maybe I'll go ahead and give that a shot, since the hardest cities are passed.
Yeah.
Now.
Thanks.
How brave are you, Tony?
So verse 26, your oarsmen brought you into many waters, but the east wind broke you in the midst of the sea. Your riches, wares, and merchandise, your mariners and pilots, your calkers and merchandisers, all your men of war who are in you, and the entire company which is in your midst, will fall into the midst of the seas on the day of your ruin. The common land will shake at the sound of the cry of your pilots. All who handle the oar, the mariners, all the pilots of the sea will come down from their ships and stand on the shore, and they will make your voice heard because of you, make their voice heard because of you. They will cry bitterly and cast dust on their heads. They will roll about in ashes. They will shave themselves completely bald because of you. Gird themselves with sackcloth and weep for you with bitterness of heart and bitter wailing. In their wailing for you, they will take up a lamentation and lament for you. What city is like Tyre, destroyed in the midst of the sea? When your wares went out by sea, you satisfied many people. You enriched the kings of the earth with your many luxury goods, with your merchandise. But you are broken by the seas and the depths of the waters. Your merchandise and the entire company will fall in your midst. All the inhabitants of the isles. That's where we are there. That's Camino Island. There. All the inhabitants of the isles will be astonished at you. Their kings will be greatly afraid, and their countenance will be troubled. The merchants among the people will hiss at you. You will become a horror and be no more forever. Where's that now?
28.
This is Ezekiel 20,
26,
15. Yeah, what's it say over there? I don't know. Yeah, I didn't look at that original, but.
Yeah, that's what my cross reference is to say for common land. Open land or pasture land.
Mm-hmm. There's another island that was mentioned in there too. One of the
Cyprus.
Yeah, there's Cyprus, and then there's another small island off of, and then there's all the islands off of Greece, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the Aegean Sea, there's tons of islands. But
yeah.
Besides that, besides the fact that there really will be, you know, islands. Where am I trying to go here? There's this idea too that. Frequently talks about the distant isles in the idea of saying distant regions and coastlands will,
mm-hmm.
in other words, this event will be so significant that
mm-hmm.
the news will travel a long distance and people will be astonished.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like saying, you know, London disappears or something
mm-hmm.
like that, where it's like something that historically was significant for a long period of time is completely gone,
mm-hmm.
and people will be shocked by the development, right?
Shocked by the looks of it or affected?
Well, both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of, you know, when it says, what city is like Tyre?
Mm-hmm.
Part of that idea is
the rippling effect.
Yeah, look what man built, right? What accomplishment and power and influence was like Tyre, and now it's gone. And so there's that, but then there's also wailing for the lack of commerce, like you're talking about, indirect influence that maybe I don't care about Tyre, but I was making money that way, you know. And so there's a financial impact, which is also what you see in the book of Revelation, in Revelation 18. This part here is very similar to Revelation 18,
mm-hmm.
Where it talks about the merchants you know, bemoaning and wailing over the loss of monetary ability to make a wealth through this trade that was going on.
Yeah, the captains.
Mm-hmm. It's very similar.
It makes a good, like, makes a good point about the point you made earlier about how, you know, when the people want to make sure something they get, they tend to get, you know, economically wealthy, thank God. And that's where all their focus is. And look what happens when it's gone. They're, you know, bemoaning the loss of it. Versus, you know, people. You know, God's focus. He blesses people because they're faithful to Him. And He does bless them with, you know, monetary good, but, you know, He wants them not to be focused on the monetary good.
These people didn't even know God. None of these people. Except for maybe Dan, the people in Dan.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say none of them did, because, I mean, one of the things that Jesus makes, one of the reasons he gets up heat in the Gospels is when he's talking about the fact that that non-Jews sometimes were the ones who were more responsive to God, right?
Yeah.
So there are exceptions, but in general, yeah, these people wouldn't. Culturally, the large number of the culture wouldn't be God-fearers.
Yeah, the reason I mention that is when it talks about in Ephesians, it talks about people who were without God.
In darkness.
In darkness, yeah. And so that's all the Gentiles that it's referring to, and these are mainly Gentile nations.
Right.
All of them. So,
right.
So they, yeah, and Tyre too. Also, so I don't understand. I mean, I could see God's wrath against Tyre or whatever, but I just don't quite understand it as being a punishment for things that they've done because they're not even God's people.
Yeah, well, I think if you so there's a bigger issue. Okay, He chose Israel, and Israel is His. You know, He gave His revelation to Israel and so forth. But it's not like the other nations of the world were without revelation about God. They didn't have the law. But like when He brings Israel in to take the land, He says, like, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why is He attributing iniquity to them? They're not Israel, right? Well, because the practices that they do are still ruled out. Just from the fact that, you know, when people got off the ark, everyone knew God, right?
Yeah.
And so as they move away, and He ends up picking Abraham to put light back into the scene, these other nations that are diverging and moving away, they're still responsible, right, for conscience and moral behavior, the law of God written on their heart and so forth. And that's why I think, you know, when you get into the book of Revelation, it talks about the tabernacle of the testimony of God, and it brings up this idea that that the law is going to judge. All people will be judged by the law, even though the law was given to Israel. So you're either going to be in the law keeper, Jesus, and not be judged by the law, or you're going to be judged by the law even if you're a Gentile and you're a lost tribe even. Because there's this whole issue we've talked about before where, you know, the generational rejection of God flows down to the offspring. They're affected by it, you know. And so I think this is one of those situations. If you go back a couple chapters, one of the things he brings out is this idea that Tyre was excited about Israel being overthrown.
Yeah.
But besides that, I think the bigger picture here, I think when you set this down against Revelation 18, you have to come back to this idea that it's more than just their treatment of Israel. It's also where they're going and their godlessness, you know. It's like Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, you know, they certainly didn't have the law, right? And look at, so there's this issue where when it talks about Israel as a light because of the law that God gave, a light to the nations, and the Gentiles who were in darkness, it's a relative term. And the Gentiles are in darkness, but part of the reason they're in darkness is they've turned off the light. Mm-hmm. But they're still, it's not like they're not responsible still.
Well, it, also in Romans 1, it says mm-hmm. that nobody has an excuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it comes back to that, that those who have much are, you know,
much
God
is required of them.
Yeah, much is required, yeah. But there's still a requirement for every son of Adam
yeah.
on the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, God could not send anyone to hell, right? I mean,
yeah.
essentially, because so the universality of sin and the fact that at least two times in history, you know, God has made himself directly known to every living person basically puts us in a position where we don't have any recourse to say, well, you know, we didn't have the synagogues and the scrolls and all that, you know, we're still responsible. So I think that's what comes down in this passage too.
It seems like what you said earlier, not only Tyre, but it goes back to the Ammonites and the Moabites and all of those. They, it was their treatment of him, Judah, right? Israel, of Jerusalem.
The earlier chapters,
yeah. So this flows right along with that then, basically.
Yeah, it has some connections there too, but you know, if you think about where God says, I'm going to bring you into a land that you haven't known across the Jordan, he's already decided he's going to kick those tribes out, and they don't even know what a Jew is, right?
Yeah.
And so they're... You know, and if you read Leviticus 18, for example, which is the most sexually deviant, you know, describing the most sexually deviant, it's talking about women mating with animals and stuff like that in there. That chapter, when it gets to the end, he says, this is what the nations in the Promised Land essentially are doing. And his whole, that whole list of things that he identifies there, you know, it has nothing to do with their treatment of Israel. It has, it's completely their defacing God's purpose for humankind and how we're supposed to live. So there's that issue. There's a, both of those things come into play. Yeah. You know, really, when you boil it down, the common denominator is God has revealed things. And then we're responsible for how we respond to that. He's revealed how we're supposed to live, what the bounds are on sexual behavior, for example. And then he's revealed, hey, I chose some people and I'm doing something with them. You know, be careful how you interact with them. And both of those things are things that he's holding us responsible for.
So when an unbeliever comes up and says that a loving God wouldn't call Israel to go in and wipe out every man, woman, child, and animal in the in a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
We could go to Leviticus. What did you say it was?
18. Mm-hmm.
And say this is the way those people were, and this is why they were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a good answer for that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and the other thing about those is if you look at the things that are listed there, there's a lot of them that fall into this category of, if people do that in private, it doesn't hurt anyone.
Yeah.
Right? And God is saying, oh, yes, it does.
Yeah. And
you just don't understand.
I've heard people use the excuse, well, the marriage bed is not defiled.
Okay.
Yeah, and so basically they're using that as an excuse. I mean, you're married, you do whatever you want to do, you know. And it seems like maybe we got to be a little careful of that, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, so it ultimately it comes down to, I mean, when you're interacting with, about all you can do is point to, like, those sorts of things and say, well, you know, God, there's tripwires, you know, for lack of a better term. There's a, you know, God draws a circle in the sand, and he says, okay, don't cross that circle. You know, and that circle is a lot bigger sometimes than we can even imagine, because we see stuff go on, and we're like, God, isn't that crossing the circle yet? You know?
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, people that have that mindset. I mean, I think there might be 1 in 100 that is really inquiring about that and doesn't understand that and is open to what you have to say. And I think the other 99,
totally,
they're just trying to throw things back in God's face. You know?
Just a little side trip here about the location of Tyre. It does say in the verse 3, you who are situated at the entrance of the sea.
Right.
That could make a case for farther west.
Oh, that's
right.
Tarshish, though, not Tyre.
Oh.
Tarshish we were talking about. Tyre is an island. It's an island right at the on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. So it is on the is at the entrance to the Mediterranean Sea, what they would call the sea at the time.
From
the land side.
Yeah.
That's Tyre?
Tyre. Siding, yeah.
So bring up your map again, would you? Where?
Yeah.
I need a little visual too. Tyre.
Yeah, so Tyre isn't shown here, but it's just on the coast right there. And actually, it's like a half. At the time this was given, it's like a half mile. The island Tyre. There's a land based city, and then there's this island by half mile offshore.
So you're talking about Tarshish, maybe
Tarshish
somewhere
was,
else.
Right. Tarshish is. Many people think it's there.
Oh.
Some think it's down the coast here, and then some people think it's in England over here. So,
What sea then? You are situated at the entrance of the sea. What sea is that?
Mediterranean. It would be talking
about. Oh, the entrance coming from
the entrance.
Direction.
Yeah, from Jerusalem. From.
I see. Gotcha.
Yeah. So, the Bible's Jerusalem.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I was going to say that mostly everything we talked about is.
Gotcha. All
right.
From Jerusalem.
It's centralized there because at the time that area was the most populated area in the world.
Right.
Since we live over here, I think.
Yeah,
we're
it doesn't look.
United
yeah,
States.
Right. And if you look at if you have maps in the back of your Bible, some of them have, depending on which ones you have, they show different empires, like the Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, and some of them. The Muslim Empire. It just depends on what all they're trying to show. But a lot of those stretched over that kind of that same area there, and so from their perspective, you know, the sea, the entrance to the sea, is to the west.
Gotcha.
Right. From our point of view, it's different.
So, I gotcha.
So notice in verse 26, the east wind broke you, and you can do a little study on east wind. It's the east wind that, you know, parted the sea across the Red Sea, you know, across the Red Sea. It was an east wind. It's the east wind that brought the quail. You know, there's a number of east wind that took away Jonah's little plant. So you see this idea of the east wind, and part of it comes from this idea that it's a bigger picture, but man worships the sun, right?
Yeah.
You'll see the term in here sometimes, Beth Shemesh. Beth Shemesh. That's the house of the rising sun, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't say the rising sun, but it's the house of the sun, which is the idea of the rising sun in the morning is what people would worship. And there's passages where they're turned away, right? They're at the entrance to the temple, which actually, if you go in the temple, you're facing west. But they have their backs to the holy place, and they're worshiping the rising sun, right? So part of this idea of the east wind is is, yeah, you might be worshiping the sun, but that's not the real power from the east. The real power is the Spirit of God that can come from the east too. Right? It's just, it's more powerful than what you're worshiping in the sun. I mean, that's,
yeah.
I'm reading, it doesn't explicitly say that, I'm just reading that in from the many passages that contrast, you know, people having eastern ways, people worshiping toward the east. Anatos is another term that means the location of rising.
Earlier in here, when I was talking about the wrath of God on Jerusalem, it talked about the wind coming from the east, which we at that time said that was Nebuchadnezzar, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, he comes from the north.
The wrath.
But
we're coming across the desert.
Right.
Here, the hot wind from the east.
So, you know, I'm not sure it's every case, but a lot of these cases, when you see the east wind, it's like, okay, you can think of it, and this would be taking it a hair too far, but you can think of it about that it's, you know, wind is like the Spirit of God. The east wind is like, okay, it's a spirit, a wind that's coming from the east. You know, it doesn't say it in the Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost, but, you know, if it had said something, it would have said that the sound of rushing mighty wind would maybe have come from the east. I don't know. It doesn't say. But there is this connection that God is trying to say, you know, his spirit is more powerful than the things you're worshiping in the east, like the rising sun. And so even when he comes back to his temple, you know, it's like when he leaves the temple, where does he go? He goes to the east, right? The Mount of Olives. And when he comes back, he's going to come, and we'll see this later in this very book, he comes back through the east gate. So his going and coming has this easterly component associated with it. And also, when the tribes camp around the tabernacle, the eastern side is the side of favor, ultimately. That's where Judah is, for example, that leads praise and so on. And so there's things that are said that sometimes are tied in with these cardinal directions and have inferences.
There's a lot of Americans that feel the same way.
Yeah.
It's all about
New
the
York,
East Coast.
Yes. If you ever go to New York.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're saying the east wind is kind of like judgment?
Yeah, I'm saying there's passage. Well, it's not always judgment, but it depends on how you look at it. Like in the case of, it's deliverance and judgment. Like in the case where they're, if you look at them escaping Egypt, right? Their back's against the wall being
mm-hmm.
the water,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the enemy is coming from the east,
mm-hmm.
and they're back, or I mean from the west, and their back's against the wall. And then God brings an east wind
mm-hmm.
to part the seas. They cross over. It's their salvation.
Mm-hmm.
But then after they get across, it's the doom
mm-hmm.
for the chariots and horsemen, right?
Because yeah.
the wind stops. And
yeah, because I was reading here in Jeremiah 18, like 17, I will scatter them before the enemy like the east wind. I will show them my back and not my face on the day of their calamity.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other part of it was this idea that, too, the east of Israel was an arid and desert area. So it's a hot, dry
mm-hmm.
wind. And I think in a lot of cases it does talk about judgment, because, like, the partridges or whatever they are, I can't remember what they're called, the quail. Yeah.
Partridges.
Yeah. Whatever they are. Yeah. The partridges that get blown out of the pear trees.
Yeah.
You know. So they're... So, yeah, it's... The east part of it has to do with, it's just the direction that God is associated with his intervention. For whatever reason, he has.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if you're not comfortable with it, you can ignore it, but it's there. You know, it's one of those things
mm-hmm.
that it says east wind in the several spots where it is God's hand of judgment coming in. And there is definitely this idea that that the temple arrangement was set up so that you came in from the east and you leave
mm-hmm.
going eastward. So when it says, you know, you can almost cut that verse in half and it just says, but the east wind, and you, all right, here comes trouble. You know, but the east wind broke you in the midst of the seas. And I think the fact that it says the east wind broke you in the midst of the seas, if you're sensitive to the rest of the Bible, you know that what he's saying is God. God broke you in the midst of the sea. And of course, the midst of the seas here, again, literally this place was an island.
Mm-hmm.
But also, what did we see in the previous chapter? That God's going to bring a series of nations like waves. And so there is also this typological connection of the nations, especially the Gentile nations, are at unrest like the ocean waves, right? And so that's, and it's tied in with this whole idea that, you know, basically the nations are used, the nations of the world are typified by an unrest, the ocean of unrest. And that's why you see like a beast arising out of the sea. For example, there's places where it talks about the sea in a negative sense, and it has this connotation of unclean things. You know, like in the case of a Jew can eat fish with scales, but anything without scales is unclean. So like pearls, clams, you know, slimy things, all the stuff. 90% of what we eat.
Bottom feeders.
So again, when they're in the midst of the seas, it's also the seas that are overthrown. The part of why it's saying there, it's saying that you're going to be buried in the sea. Part of what it's saying is these nations are the waves, like we saw in the previous chapter. These nations that come against you are part of the seas that are overthrowing you. You're literally in the seas, but the nations are acting like waves as they fall on you over the years. You will fall in the midst of the seas on the day of your ruin. But they are in the midst of the seas too, so, you know. So, and like in verse 34, you are broken by the seas. You're not just destroyed in the midst, but you're broken by the seas, and that's you know, pretty clearly a reference back to the previous chapters where it talks about a series of waves will come against them. And so this merchandise in verse 34, this whole idea of merchandise comes into play in a big way in Babylon in Revelation, but also when we get here and start talking about the king of Tyre, there's this whole idea of, by the abundance of your trading you became filled with violence. So trading in itself isn't really a problem. It's just that the trading was used, you know, the merchandising and trading was used to basically enrich and become independent and gain power and power that was abused. So you'll see this idea of when he says your merchandise and the entire company will fall in your midst. This idea that the things that became an idol for you, essentially, your trade and your merchandising, which, you know, boy, are we close to that model today. I mean, look at the emphasis on consumerism that we have in our situation today. You know, for example, I mean, you know, take the United States, right? Where is everything made?
China.
Who has a really good human rights record? Not China. Mm-hmm. Why is everything so cheap from China?
Yeah.
Who's making half of
slave
it?
Labor.
Slave labor or people who are really poorly taken care of and really having a hard time making ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
And what are we buying? Our Chinese iPads.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, well, they're barely affordable because they're made in China. If they're made in the United States, they cost $15,000 each. But you can see, even in our behavior, this, you can see this playing out, right?
Mm-hmm.
we're willing to look the other way on stuff because, well, that'll save me some money. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I do it.
Welcome to Walmart.
Yeah.
That's the whole reason that place exists.
And so there's a sense in which we get, you know, we're tempted.
Mm-hmm.
And we get lured into it, just like these people here.
Wouldn't we be foolish to go spend more for something?
Not if the principles, not if we as a country said, you know, we're not giving China the most favored nation like we did for a long time. Because we don't agree with their practices.
Yeah, well, we never have agreed with slave labor and things like that. But you're trapped because your country, what the people in your country deem, that's what you do.
Well, sure. It's like when McDonald's or whoever the first few companies said they were going to support the homosexual agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm going to boycott them.
Yeah.
And I'm going to boycott them. And I'm going to boycott them.
Yeah,
and then in about 6 months,
I can't
use a cell phone.
Yeah.
I can't use a computer.
I can't drink coffee. I can't go to the bank.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter which computer I go. Intel, Apple, Microsoft, Verizon, AT&T. And pretty soon you're like, you know, I need to go to Mars in order to boycott this situation. So there's it's not as obvious and straightforward like you point out, for sure.
I mean, if it was, then we could easily do that. I mean, if it was an individual thing or even a small group thing, you know, I could do that. But
you do have to wonder, as a nation, when we say, we're going to extend favored trading to a country that historically we have, you know, for a long time we haven't because of a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely don't love us. They love our money, and we love our money, but we love their goods. They love our money. They don't like us, and, you know, like firms that go over there to do business have a difficult time, you know, like, you know, Google or any of these firms that go over there because there's all this censorship going on, Facebook, et cetera. And so they're over there in a closed environment trying to somehow make their thing work. And there's a culture clash going on. And so we're prepared and trying to look the other way on it. And of course people say things like, well, if you really want the people there to benefit, then you need to trade with them a lot and get them sucked into Western consumerism, and then eventually democracy will erupt in there and they'll become consumers like us and everybody will be happy and we'll actually undermine them to our greed.
It is changing somewhat.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Well, part of that, I think, though, is globalism. I mean, the media, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't... It's pretty hard to be in some downtrodden situation and you flip on, you finally get TVs and stuff and you flip them on and there's these people in these other parts of the world that, gosh, look at all the stuff they have and all the freedoms they have. It's kind of, you know, you got to be like North Korea and really cut stuff off to keep that going. But, and it is a complex topic, but still you have to wonder when you see these situations where, you know, essentially, it's gotten to the point now where our multinational corporations have more vested interest in maintaining these other regimes because of the money they want to make, and they don't feel an alliance to our nation as much. And again, this is another big topic where they go offshore with the tax situation too. But and I'm not saying that there's not motivation for doing that, but there's still this issue where merchandise has this influence that eclipses principle.
That's all supposed to change for the new president.
Yeah. He's busy backpedaling as fast as he can so far.
So far.
But so that's what I'm saying when I'm bringing in this merchandise thing, when you see this pop up, this merchandise deal, it has to do with the temptation of merchandise. And so, it's no it's not like an accident that the last guy who really has this amazing government, he's going to get a hold of you through the lack of being able to buy and sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need that for food. You know, so that's a little bit different, but it's so severe that it's still merchandise. He's going to control merchandise. And of course, if you're paying attention lately, you're seeing how merchandise is getting more and more controlled because, oh, well, there's, you know, we've got to get rid of cash, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's being used for terrorism and so on and so forth. So there's this whole issue of merchandise, controlling merchandise, and then also the temptation of merchandise. And it's just, it's a big thing. And so if you even like people in China say that are working on Apple assembly lines or whatever, maybe they're better off than the people, their neighbors, that could be. But ultimately, when you look at the idea is to try and get things built as cheaply as possible to make the most margin.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily to offer it at the lowest price. There's
mm-hmm.
this business of margin
yeah.
in there too.
Mm-hmm.
CEO's got to have a lot.
Yeah, and I think you can clearly say today, if you look at the disparity between the CEO and the average Joe working in the company, it's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, it's just absolutely enormous. And I think in the past, you've always had really, really rich people in the world.
Welcome.
But not at every single company.
Welcome to capitalism.
Yeah.
Which actually brings about the best living standards in the world.
Mm-hmm. Because of selfishness.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason that the United States was bound for doom from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
you know?
In a sense, yes, I know what you're saying. It's the hardest, it's a difficult system to sustain because it requires a greater character and a greater
responsibility.
Try to
be moral in a capitalistic society, it's kind of hard.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you've gone anywhere where it's more of a socialist or communist, you'll see the insulation falling off the
yeah,
wire.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work real well because, well, even in a church it can be a problem.
Because
mm-hmm. there's no ownership. Whenever there's no ownership, stuff just doesn't
yeah.
get taken care of.
Yeah.
You know? And...
No. It's totally unrelated. It's something that... It's a personal thing with Mary's mom. And
mm-hmm.
anyway.
So, you know, and I... In the absence of a sinless one, the system we have is pretty good. And that's, of course, when the king comes, he's sinless, and that makes a big difference, right? And it is a little bit, I'll have to say, the rabbit. Here, give me the rabbit for a minute. I'm kind of frustrated by young people today. I'm not hearing this from you, so I'll make that clear. But and you're not that young anyway, anymore. But
yeah.
Sorry. I'm getting late, not
that young. Yeah.
You know,
the age female.
But I'm frustrated today by how many young people I hear criticizing democracy
mm-hmm.
and giving an ear to socialism
mm-hmm.
and other communistic type ideas
mm-hmm.
because they see the abuse of democracy, but they don't seem, I don't think they have a clue about what the benefits are of democracy if it's run well
mm-hmm.
versus the cost of the other systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the frightening things in our country right now is that we have a mass of young people who
mm-hmm.
don't really know what is the United States about, why was it founded, what are the
I'm
principles.
Just talking about that.
and as time goes along, I mean, you saw it already with Bernie Sanders,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this race between people maturing, getting wise, and changing their ideas versus changing the country.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, we pray and hope that over time, as those people grow older, they'll come to see that given sinful man, the system we have in the United States, when it's working properly, which it isn't really right now, but when it's working properly, it's so much better than the alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Those are our future leaders.
Mm-hmm.
About.
Yeah.
I believe back in the 60s, I don't know when he did it, but I remember when, and I think I've said this before, I remember when Khrushchev took his shoe off at the UN, banged on the table, and said, "We will bury you." And I think he was right, but I think it's a much slower process than they were thinking about. And I think that socialism is taught in all our schools now,
mm-hmm.
and in the universities especially, mm-hmm. and in all these. All these high school kids are out picketing, are out rioting,
Burlington.
You know,
and or whatever you call
what do high school
lockout.
Kids know
lockout.
About politics? I sure didn't know anything about
yeah,
politics.
They know even less now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
all they want is a free education.
Well, somebody says
they're taught they're gonna get
sure.
I would have been out there just because I was out of school.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. If somebody offered me a chance, school and go march down the
but
street.
But what they don't realize
know.
Is if the government's gonna provide that for you, they're also going to start telling you what you're going to take.
Yeah, well, they
and then they're gonna tell you what job you're gonna have.
Well, they're gonna
you
tell
know,
us to pay
not,
for.
That's obviously the benefits between socialism and democracy. Both works. Almost on the same principle, except for democracy is a like what would you say is that people are willingly cooperative with each other versus socialism
mm-hmm.
is mandated cooperativeness.
Mm-hmm.
You get told to be cooperative.
Right, and
the
thing
will
and here's
be cooperative.
And here's the difference: the
old.
Carrot is more powerful than any stick every day,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if you're motivated
yeah.
to do things out of self-interest, which is your sinful,
life.
Selfish person, which is a pretty strong engine,
mm-hmm.
Versus the other one where you're told to do things, that's like goes against your sinful, selfish person, right? And
mm-hmm.
so